Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the LSE and to this public debate on genetically modified organisms, jointly organised by two of the LSE's youngest research centres. This event is hosted by the Centre for Environmental Policy and Governance and also by BIOS, the Research Centre for the Study of Bioscience, Biomedicine, Biotechnology and Society. My name is Yvonne Rydin and I'm Director of the Centre for Environmental Policy and Governance. GMOs, and in particular their introduction into agricultural practice, has been one of the most hotly debated environmental and public health topics of recent years. We have a distinguished panel here tonight to take forward this debate. As you will note, we are missing one, but I'm sure he's on his way, and we will incorporate him when he arrives. I will introduce each speaker before they speak. The format for this evening is that each of our three speakers will talk for about 10 to 15 minutes. We will then have a slightly shorter response from our two LSE-based discussants before opening up the discussion to the floor. So I do encourage you please to consider your comments and discussions and questions as you listen to our panel. Our first speaker tonight is Professor Chris Pollock. Chris Pollock is a research director of the Institute of Grassland and Environment Research in Aberystwyth. His personal research is in the area of plant responses to environmental stress, and he also has research interests in the responses of agricultural crops to climate change. He's currently chairing the Independent Scientific Steering Committee for the programme of farm-scale evaluations of GM crops, and is also chair of the Research Priorities Group for Sustainable Farming and Food. Since September, he has been chairman of ACER, the Advisory Committee on Releases to the Environment, which inter alia advises government on the risk to human health and the environment from the release and marketing of GMOs. He is a fellow of the Royal Agricultural Society and was awarded a CBE for services to the environment in 2002. Professor Chris Pollock.
Thank you very much. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's quite a daunting task to try and summarise the GM debate in 15 minutes, but I like a challenge, so I'm actually going to go much broader than that. I'm going to try and address four interrelated issues. I want to talk very briefly about the role of technology in farming and food production, because I think unless you understand that, you can't understand the genesis of the debate. I want to talk about the interrelationship between farming and farming technology and the environment, then move specifically on to GM as an example of a novel agricultural technology, and then, assuming that you haven't booed me off the platform by then, to pick up some of the wider issues associated generically with the introduction of new technologies. I'm an old man. I can remember rationing. It wasn't much fun, actually. It was particularly not much fun if your mother used to swap your sweet ration for fags, as mine did. And in one lifetime, we've moved from food rationing to a position where actually the proportion of money that people spend on food is the lowest that it's ever been. And that includes a massive shift away from the purchase of raw produce to spending money on processed food. There have been two drivers for this. The first of them has been novel technology. The application of biological technology has increased yield, compound rate of 2.5% per year since the war, has reduced losses, and has begun to reduce inputs. Work at my own institute has shown that by the use of mathematical modelling, you can lower the amount of nitrogen that you put onto crops by 15 to 20% with a minimal reduction in yield. We've done a lot about improving quality. All of that has been through the application of appropriate technologies at the farm level. And it's meant that we've moved from food security being an issue in Northern Europe to one which barely ever registers on the political or the economic radar screen. One other point I'd make, though, is that you need to invest to stand still in farming. This is not a zero-sum game. Even if you are content with the situation you have at the moment, you still have to invest. And the other thing that's happened since the war is there's been a huge shift in investment in scientific research away from the public sector and towards the private sector. The second big driver in the move from rationing to plenty has been government manipulation. Production subsidies across Northern Europe average out at about 30 to 40% of farm income. If you take everything into account, in Wales they're 101% of farm income. That was historically valid at a time when food shortages were a major issue. But at the moment, the negatives outweigh the positives as surpluses mount. So we're now at a position where we have to consider the impacts of technology in a broader sense than merely self-preservation. We have to consider the impacts of technology on the environment. But again, don't get suckered into the idea that this is a new issue. It's not. It's as old as agriculture. The biggest impact on biological diversity in the United Kingdom was the deforestation in the Iron Age. This removed one huge deme across almost the whole of England and Wales to produce charcoal and generate grazing land, and reduced it, exchanged it for another deme with considerably poorer biological diversity. The Enclosures Act hastened that process. The development of chemical agriculture hastened that process. But it is as old as agriculture. There's another point I'd like to make about this novel agricultural technology that gets blamed for things. There is a widespread tendency to think that the chemicals are the problem. Too many people read Rachel Carson too often. The evidence to support this is frankly tendentious. What we're really talking about here is competition for sunshine. In the Middle Ages, the weeds won and we suffered. Now, there's a tendency for us to win and the weeds to suffer. And therefore, the natural food chain loses out to the productive food chain. And of course, in Britain, Northern Europe, as opposed to North America, these two are interdigitated. There is very little climax vegetation left in the United Kingdom. The majority of it is managed in one way or another. And the way in which that management is carried out determines the balance between production for you and production for the things that people have come to want from the countryside. How can I prove this? I can prove it very easily, because you only have to look at the case of grassland. The decline of farmland birds in grassland has been as precipitous, in some cases slightly more so, than the decline in cereal land. And yet agrochemicals, by and large, are not used on grassland. In a large survey that was carried out by one of the ornithological organisations and my institute, the only positive correlates with the decline in bird populations that there were in the grassland sites that they looked at was a shift from hay production to silage cutting, so you don't allow flowers to flower and seed, and the excessive use of nitrogen, which means the grasses drown out the wild plants. So you can produce these huge changes, these huge shifts in balance in terms of what ecologists call habitat degradation without the use of agrochemicals. Okay, that's the prelude. Now we move on to the role of GM as a new agricultural technology. Not the first new agricultural technology, not the last agricultural technology, not the only new agricultural technology that's being introduced at the time, but the one that for one reason or another has captured everybody's interest. Now, I will make an assertion that I know a very considerable number of people in this audience will disagree virulently with, and it'll be interesting to see how the questioning goes. In my view, genetic manipulation is a novel technology. There is absolutely no doubt about it. You can do things with GM that you cannot do with any other method of genetic reorganization. However, the outputs from that technology do not seem to me have any evidence that they are qualitatively different or more concerning than the outputs from any other breeding technology. And a trivial example of this is the fact that there are GM and non-GM herbicide-tolerant rape varieties. And the impact that they have on the environment in terms of the way in which the weeds are managed, the use of broad-spectrum herbicides, is identical. And there are arguments that you can produce, and I'll drag them out in question if you want, about gene flow, that's vertical and horizontal gene flow, about allergenicity and toxicity. If there's nothing fundamentally alien about the technology, then you have to start looking at it in a case-by-case basis. And that, I think, is probably the first message that I would put across. It's not the technology, it's the products and fruits of that technology that need to be looked at. And there's a very good example that I can give you. It is very difficult, I think, to produce a compelling case that would say that the introduction of BT, insect-resistant cotton, into an area where there is no wild relative of cotton would have a negative environmental effect, because the reduction in the use of insecticides is so massive that the impact, the footprint, is reduced, and there is good experimental evidence from a range of countries to demonstrate this. By the same token, if you were to take a wide-spectrum insect-resistant forage grass and try and introduce that into the United Kingdom, when there's a mass of wild relatives and where the grass itself feeds both cows and the natural environment, I personally would have very significant concerns, no matter how that particular variety was bred, whether it was GM or whether it was conventional. It's not the technology, it's what you do with it. It gets worse than that because I think the debate is complicated by other issues as well. It's very interesting reading the submissions that have come out at the end of the farm-scale trials. The number of people who are concerned about GM because of issues about capitalism, about the protection of IP that they feel, intellectual property, that they feel should be within the public domain. There's a huge debate about the precautionary principle. I'm not even sure I can define the precautionary principle in a way that satisfies me. All I know is that some of the definitions that you see in the press are really quite radically different from the way in which the general consensus would work with it. And we scientists are perhaps, in a way, our own worst enemies in this, because the scientific method only allows you to falsify a hypothesis. So you can never say something is true, you can only say there is no evidence to suggest that it isn't. Now that's got us by quite nicely. You can say exactly the same thing about Dalton's atomic theory. We still don't know that it's true. It could be falsified tomorrow. It hasn't stopped a large industry which has done an enormous amount to improve the lot of humanity being set up on what is, in some ways, an untested theory. So you don't have to have the proof of scientific principle in order to exploit scientific knowledge. The two have to live together. So what I'm proposing in this is that there are some discontinuities in the GM debate that really don't actually have very much to do with GM. What they have to do with is the way in which we look at this novel technology. And that what I'm suggesting is that you have to look at these things case by case. You also have to move away from an absolute discussion of whether something is bad or good and look at cost-benefit analysis. And you have to ask it for agricultural technologies, novel agricultural technologies as a whole. One of the big problems, in my view, with the GM debate is that it is the lever which can be twisted and turned, whereas other agricultural technologies don't have that kind of lever. So on one hand, I'm going to offend the next speaker by suggesting that agricultural technology as a whole should be scrutinised in terms of its environmental impact, and I'm going to offend the third speaker by suggesting that GM is not actually the fount of all concerns about agriculture in the environment. I'd like to finish by picking up some of the wider issues, because I do believe that actually in some cases the GM is a proxy debate. Let me say at first that I'm a strong proponent of public choice. I believe that labelling, for example, in this particular issue, is something that it's very important to have. But you have to recognise that with consumer power comes consumer responsibility. People have to recognise, not only that when they exercise this choice, but they have to recognise the consequences of that. And I do think there are going to be some fairly significant consequences if there is local rejection, blanket rejection of genetic manipulation. The first consequence is going to be an effect upon the producers of commodity products in those countries where the technology might be rejected. Because if you are producing for a global market, cost control is absolutely vital. If you cannot produce as cheaply as your competitors, you will go out of business. Now, actually, the United Kingdom seems quite cool about that in many elements. It's let its entire machine tool industry go out of business and move it to China without apparently turning a hair. So it may be that this is part of the way in which a society develops. But I think people should recognise that this is a risk and that it means losing control over part of the food chain. There's also a global effect upon moving production around. Despite what you might read in the more hyperbolical press, UK agriculture is actually fairly sustainable and has a pretty good environmental record. And shifting production somewhere else as a way of not having to deal with the problem on your own doorstep can have significant global environmental consequences, in particular countries that mine resources like soil and water, will end up by moving into markets in order to avail themselves of opportunity. And you need to be a little bit careful about whether you're swapping something that you don't like on your own doorstep for something that you probably should like even less on somebody else's. But in my view, the most important element of the GM debate and its wider issues is that it is a paradigm for the debate about technological progress. I'm actually delighted to see that many of the statements about GM mirror almost exactly the objections that were raised to the Stockton and Darlington Railway in the 19th century. Speeds over 30 miles an hour are not natural and people will die as a consequence. Whole tracts of the country will be laid waste by the fumes and chemicals that come out of these hideous monsters. For train, read GM. Between then and, I don't know, somewhere in the mid-80s, was the golden age of technological advance, where, for reasons that I don't understand, because I don't have a social science background, there was a fairly good acceptance of the positive benefits of technology, and an acceptance of risk that somehow seems to be disappearing now. There was confidence in the ability of technology to mitigate. And I would argue that you need to think very seriously about whether you turn your back on that rather empirical approach. Life expectancy is still increasing by a year, a decade in some countries, some developed countries. Quality of life is increasing. What are we pitching at? How do we move from a position where we are now, which is where we are a highly risk-averse society? And you've only got to look at the debate about mobile phones to see just how incredibly risk-averse people are now. They use them, but they don't want the masts anywhere near them. How illogical can you be? I think the challenge for a post-industrial economy is to try and find a way of living with technological advance. Because inevitably, it seems to me, and I'm now doing probably what no human being should ever do, which is to talk about economics at the LSE without knowing anything about the subject. But it does seem to me that we have to move to a situation in which we, as a post-industrial country, predominantly, avail ourselves of technological advance. We have to do that in a way that carries the community with us. We have to do that in a way that prevents us from doing what we have been so good at in the past, which is finding it out here and exploiting it somewhere else. So I really do believe that this is an important debate, not because I think GM of itself is important, not when you consider the size of the farming industry within the UK economy, but I do think it's a proxy debate for a vital issue for Britain in the 21st century. And I think we really need to prevail upon all the protagonists in this debate to be considerably more honest than they have been about disentangling what it is that they wish to achieve. The NGOs, the government, the companies. Because unless the people who live in this country are, if you like, satisfied with the processes of debate and exchange that allow us to introduce new technologies and benefit from them, then I really do worry about our progress. So, my conclusion is, I welcome this debate. I'm quite happy to take anything that either the next speakers or the audience will throw at me. But just remember, who keeps you alive while you're having the debate? It's him and me. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next speaker is the Right Honourable Michael Meacher. Most importantly, Michael Meacher is an alumnus of the LSE, but he has also been a Labour Party Member of Parliament since 1970 and held numerous senior positions within the party, both in opposition and in government. He was Privy Councillor in 1997 and from 1997 to 2003, Minister of State for the Environment. He has a wide range of political interests, including environmental protection, sustainable development, economic policy, industry and trade policy, reform of the machinery of government, reform of the media, housing, education and social services. But most recently, he has become strongly associated with the GM debate and has spoken on many occasions on his concerns with GMOs. Michael Meacher, thank you.
Well, thank you very much. That sounds extremely impressive until you realise it's me. advantage of listening to Professor Pollock, it's always very helpful when someone else starts off the debate, is I was thinking as I was listening, two things. One is, what is the role of technology? And incidentally, I don't actually think, Chris, it's just you and Ben that keep us alive. Actually, I think it is a much, much, much wider network than that, actually. But the real issue I would have with what you've said is what technology is for. Your argument seemed to be that the irresistible advance of technology is something that we should all absolutely accommodate, whereas I would take the view that, of course, technology is extremely desirable. Science is extremely desirable. The last 300 years of the Enlightenment has been amazing in terms of its advances. But in the end, technology is the servant of people. And it is what people want is what in the end matters. And it does seem to me extraordinary that if GM is as good as you seem to think it is, that there are so many millions of people in the advanced societies who have extreme doubts about this. Now, maybe they're wrong, maybe we're all wrong, but in the end, it isn't the case, it seems to me, that we've got to accept this technology because there really isn't another alternative, and the sooner we do so, the better. The other thing, which I didn't get from your talk, is what really are the advantages of this technology? Now, maybe I missed it, but I think they do need to be stated. Now, as far as I know, and I stand to be corrected, there are mainly two things that people say in favour of this technology. Firstly, that it is a scientific and focused technology, which is much more effective, much more directive than old-fashioned breeding. Now, in some senses, that is true, but it is also wildly inaccurate. This is not a very focused, directed, scientific new technology. It is actually a very crude one. It is very unfocused. It works with great uncertainty and with unpredictable effects, and it produces a lack of stability in the plants where this happens. That is because the GM DNA is injected into the plant, is fired into the plant in an extremely crude fashion. Maybe we shall improve on that in time. I think it's quite likely. But out of a sequence which has developed over hundreds of millions of years that nature has determined, far better than we ever will, is the best sequence for the organism. And to change that, to disrupt that in an unpredicted and unpredictable way is a hazardous thing to do. It is not what it is cracked up to be in terms of scientific. Secondly, I think it is often said, and Professor Pollock didn't actually touch on this, but it is often said that, of course, GM is the answer to feeding the world. Well, I give you credit, Chris, you didn't say that. It is an absolutely, utterly ridiculous argument. It is a huge indictment of our world that there are 800 million people at this moment who are starving out of about 6 billion. But the reasons for that are not the lack of GM. The reasons for that is that the vast majority of them live in developing countries which are held in an extremely discriminated position within the world's global trading system. They often have appallingly bad governance, which destroys much of their country. There is gross maldistribution of land in many of those countries. And, of course, and we have to recognize this, there are, in many cases, virtually no population management measures. And it is a very, very, very serious problem, arguably the worst problem, that with all the wealth that we have, there are so many, at least 2 billion people, who certainly do not have enough. But the idea that GM is the answer to that is utterly ridiculous. GM's role, if it has any at all, is totally marginal. Yes, I think GM could be a useful technology in terms of dealing with saline soils, in terms of dealing with arid soils in deserts, and there may well be other uses that we can develop. That is all helpful, and we shouldn't reject it, but not to suggest that the real function of GM is to feed the world. That is, of course, an argument which has got up by the biotech companies, by Monsanto, because they have to recognize that there are no consumer benefits as yet in any of these products. But they want to have a socially useful purpose when actually their motive is a totally different one and an utterly commercial and self-interested one. So I think we ought to be honest about the situation. Now, I don't think it is the case that GM is another technology. It does, and Chris was perfectly fair, I think, in pointing this out. It will do some things that no other technology will do, that nature would never do. It will cross the species barrier. That isn't to say we shouldn't pursue the technology, but it is to say that we should do it in an extremely careful way, and certainly very regulated. It is not necessary. I'm not against GM as such. Let me make perfectly clear, I'm a skeptic, probably the most skeptic on this platform, but I am not saying that it is wrong or bad. I think it would be absurd to say that. I am simply saying that we are nowhere near yet the point where we can justify commercial production before we know a great deal more about the impacts, and I'll come on to that in a moment. But the whole point is GM is not necessary. Man has fed himself on this planet for 150,000 years without the slightest problems, apart from those that I've been mentioning, because of the maldistributions of human societies brought about by humans. GM is not necessary. It may be useful, but it certainly isn't actually necessary. It is risky. It does produce novel substances. Everyone agrees about that. They do produce, of course, allergies. There is plenty of evidence of that. There is quite a lot of statistical evidence that the level of allergies has increased substantially, like twice or more fold since GM was introduced. Doesn't mean to say GM caused it all, I don't believe it did, but it certainly suggests that there may be some connection. It uses extremely powerful chemicals, broad spectrum chemical pesticides, like for example glufosinate, which is a neurotoxin, and a teratogen, in other words, can harm embryos, very powerful chemicals, the use of which I think needs to be very, very carefully regulated if we use them at all. It injects the GM DNA into the plant using viruses, because viruses are particularly good at injecting their DNA into an organism. But of course, having done that, they're also very good at jumping out and into other parts of the organism. And certainly the suggestion that GM DNA has been found after a meal in one famous case in Newcastle where it was found in gut bacteria, although this is disputed, but it is certainly enough again to be very careful about. The effects are not immediately apparent. For example, in India, a cotton harvest was completely destroyed when the cotton bolls were deformed, which was again a result which had never been expected. And I leave this to last because this is the one so often quoted, but there are plenty of scientific reasons for being careful about this. People are deeply anxious about this, and I would suggest for very good reasons. We all remember BSE. We were told by the Southwell Committee, the elite of the establishment, that it was completely safe, it would never transfer to human beings. 4-5 years later, it was discovered that it did. Now, GM, of course, is totally different, and there's no direct analogy from one to the other, but people are deeply suspicious. And I think it is very sensible for people to take an attitude that we don't need this, it is not necessary, its uses are relatively marginal. If we're going to use it at all, let's have exhaustive testing to make absolutely sure that the minimal gains that we might get out of it are greater than the potentially huge downside risks. And that is my position. I think it's probably the position of most people, and I think that is what should guide government policy. Now, first of all, on this question of health testing, I'm always amazed people when I say that there have been virtually no clinical tests, biochemical tests of the impact of eating GM foods on human beings. Which seems almost unbelievable. The reason for that is what the biotech companies do when they bring forward a new GM product is to look at a similar non-GM product in terms of nutrients, in terms of toxins, in terms of allergens, the substances that cause allergies, and if they are largely the same, in other words, this famous phrase, substantially equivalent, they are just deemed to be safe. The assumption is simply made that they are safe. And my view is that I think the vast majority of people will not accept that that is adequate. They want deliberate repeated regular testing, as happens over drugs, never pharmaceuticals. And since these are novel products with unknown effects, I think that's a reasonable demand. Secondly, over allergies, as I've said, there was a famous case with Starlink GM maize in America, where I think 50 people went down with allergic reactions, one or two of them quite life-threatening. There's a Newcastle case, which I've already quoted. And there is the general uncertainty, and this is not me, I'm not a doctor, I'm not in a position to make statements about this, but both the Royal Society, the BMA, and the Medical Research Council have all expressed considerable doubts without further testing of the impact on the immune and endocrine systems, on organ development, on metabolism, and on gut flora. So I say, first of all, until there is much more testing in all of these respects, I think it is unjustified to proceed. Secondly, the impact on the environment. Now, we've just had the results of the environmental farm-scale evaluations. And as I'm sure everyone knows here, there were three crops. There were oilseed rape, beet, and maize. In respect of oilseed rape and beet, the judgment after 4 years under the excellent supervision of Professor Pollock was that there was greater harm to the environment from GM cultivation of oilseed rape and beet than there was of conventional oilseed rape and beet. In the case of maize, it appeared to be the other way round, but as has been said afterwards, that was mainly for two reasons. One is that Bayer said to those who were cultivating the GM maize that they should only spray once, and of course therefore more weeds grew up, therefore there was more life in the wildlife in the fields and the environmental impacts were less. But of course no farmer would ever spray once. They would certainly spray twice, and sometimes in particular cases might spray three times. The environmental impacts in those cases would obviously be far, far greater. On the conventional maize side, the use of the chemical there was mainly atrazine. Now, God moves in mysterious ways, his wonders to perform, and it amazed me that a fortnight before these results came out, atrazine was banned in the EU as being a particularly nasty, toxic, and persistent chemical. So that the comparison with conventional maize using atrazine as a chemical weed killer is now completely invalid. And I think if one did, if one had a different chemical and one replicated the test, you would have the same result as in the other two. But the main argument is that there has still been no examination of soil residues, of soil bacteria, nothing about transgene flow, which was not included in the study. There was very little about birds, although a proxy was certainly used because we are concerned about plummeting bird populations. There was no examination of how one could protect organic crops from cross-contamination. And above all, the key point, there was nothing written into the way the trials were conducted which would replicate how farmers would actually behave in real life when they are primarily concerned about maximizing commercial yield rather than minimizing environmental impact, and you would get two very different results if you moved from one to the other. My third concern is indeed organic. I'm not an organic fetishist. Organic is never going to be more than a small part of our agriculture. But it is a part of our agriculture that people want more of. Three quarters of our organic products are imported. Some of those will always be imported because we can't grow them here, but many we could grow here on a much larger scale, and we ought to grow here. That is the only sensible agricultural policy. But the real issue is, how do you prevent cross-contamination? Now, I went to Canada a few months ago to see what happened in Saskatchewan, which is the agricultural province, where I found, and I found this very alarming, that organic oilseed rape in Canada has been virtually wiped out because even despite the space of the prairies, it is impossible to protect organic crops from cross-contamination. And if that cannot happen in Canada, then in our very small islands with farms jostling cheek by jowl, it'll certainly be impossible here. And I would certainly say until we can ensure that all parts of agriculture, conventional and organic, are not going to be harmed by the introduction of GM, then we should not go ahead. And the fourth thing, and there are only four things, fourth thing that I want to say is about labelling, which again Chris mentioned. Of course it is very important that there should be labelling. When I was a minister, I had hundreds if not thousands of letters on this subject, and Linda will remember because she replied to most of them. The fact is, I do sign them, but only after reading them, of course, Linda. But the fact is, hundreds of people, if not thousands of people, said, we don't want you to go ahead with this at all. We're totally opposed. But if you do, we want you to ensure that there is GM-free labelling. In other words, when I go in and buy something on the supermarket shelves and it hasn't got a label on, then I want to be sure that it is not GM. Now, the only way to ensure that is to have a label at the level of detectability. That is about 0.1%. The level which the EU has introduced is 0.9%. There's an awful lot of politicking behind that absurd figure. It doesn't represent anything scientific. It's a political compromise. But the key point is it is not at the level of detectability. So if after these rules are introduced and you go into a shop and you see a pot or a jar or a packet and it's got no label on, you won't know whether that is GM-free and has no GM in it at all, or whether it contains up to nearly 1% GM. I don't think that that is acceptable. So I make my case. One, we need exhaustive health testing of this technology. It may well have uses, but we certainly need to secure the downside much more than we have yet. Secondly, we need much fuller environmental testing than the rather limited farm-scale evaluation trials we've had. Thirdly, we need a system of coexistence. That's the code word for saying how all the parts of agriculture can live together without damaging the others. And fourthly, the question of labelling so that people who do not want to have GM, and there are certainly millions of them, are able actually to do so. I'm a supporter of the Currie Commission. I'm a supporter of a sustainable, local, high-quality agriculture. And Ben, I know, is also a very strong supporter of that. He takes a very different view on GM from me. But I hope the one thing on which we can agree, that that is the way of the future. And if GM at some point into the future can play a role in that, fine. But not yet. Thank you.
Thank you. Our third speaker is Sir Ben Gill, also a CBE. Ben Gill has been a farmer since 1978 with a mixed farm in North Yorkshire, producing cereal, sugar beet and coppice willow, the latter for renewable energy projects. He also rears sheep and lambs, if I was right. In 1998, he was elected president of the National Farmers Union. He has served on the Agriculture and Food Research Council and then the Biotechnology and Biological Research Council, and is currently on the Governing Council of the John Innes Centre. He has been heavily involved in EU policy on agriculture, and while he is shortly to step down for the presidency of the NFU, he continues to act as president of the Confederation of European Agriculture. Ben Gill.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the invitation to come this evening. I think I should perhaps just explain, I do still have to farm. It's part of the job commitment to do so. I started farming on my own right in 78. I was born on a farm 1950. 1st of January 1950, and have always been associated with farming. Indeed, in fact, my degree is in agriculture. The NFU is an organisation. My patch in the UK represents England and Wales, and although the press, if you read the press, would make you believe otherwise, we represent about three quarters on a voluntary basis, it's voluntary subscription, of the working land in this country. And that land and those farmers and growers who fix and farm that land cover a wide variety of opinions on GM technology, almost as many opinions as there are different types of or subsets of technology within the spectrum of genetic modification. And neither speakers so far this evening have mentioned this, I think, very basic point, because to me, ethically, there are different commentaries, different perspectives, whether you're talking about within species, between species, or between kingdom technologies and use of GM as a whole. I personally don't feel happy about xenotransplantation. Don't take any offence, Michael, but I don't fancy having your heart here. Or I don't fancy having a pig's heart here. But my opinion may change in years to come if I need a pig's heart. But that's how I feel at the moment. But I think we need to look at those aspects and bear that in mind. The overall objective that we have is to ensure the responsible use of any new technology, and we've gone through plenty in our time. And I would agree with Michael when he says technology should always be the servant of the people. I think that's a given, just as any science or any study should be used to further the benefit of mankind. But as Chris has pointed out, all too often it isn't black and white, because very often what you're doing is seeking to further society by often going forward in the hope that you haven't missed something out, because proving a negative is always that much harder in life, because there are always unforeseens. The issue of food security is one that Chris has brought up. Michael said we should never look upon it as an issue of feeding the world, and then went on to base his argument that as if we were arguing it on feeding the world. But food security is an issue that was with us 40 years ago, has gone away. I do wonder, though, with the climate change that we're facing today, whether or not that may come full circle. You may not be aware, as consumers, unless you have farming relevance, that the world wheat stocks have fallen in the last 4 years from 120 days to 60 days. China, that was exporting 30 million tonnes of wheat in 1999, has suddenly come onto the market and is importing probably as much this year, which has led to a dramatic rise in freight charges for shipping, because they're into the world market and stocks have fallen. This has seen prices rise quite dramatically in the UK. If I'd been selling wheat this time last year, I would have been selling it for less than £60 a tonne. On today's market, it's in excess of £100 per tonne. And this issue is going full circle, and it comes from a point that perhaps Michael and I would have more common ground you'd be surprised on, and that is some of the farming practices in some of the parts of the world have been irresponsible and have destroyed our landscape, and to wit that is the problem in part of China, which has led to this massive turnaround in their demands. And food security could become an issue. I agree it is not at the moment. Now, I thought I'd just look at the feed scale evaluation trials and pick up on some of the points that Michael's made, just to take it a little bit further forward. Essentially, what these trials have shown is that if you reduce the weed populations, then you have an effect on those parts of biodiversity that are dependent on the weeds. Actually, that's not really very surprising, if you think about it. But that's what farming's been about, as Chris highlighted as he went through his presentation. Farming has been the domestication of plants and animals over the centuries for the benefit of mankind. We've gone on with the technologies that have developed from the four-course rotation to build on new crops that have come in, developing the crops. I find it interesting that the BBC ran a piece, I forget if it was earlier this week or last week, I just caught it by chance, berating the problems of the drought this autumn in parts of southeast England, which have meant that probably a third of the oilseed rape crop will not have germinated and will be destroyed, and the consequences that's going to have on bird life next year because of the seeds that will not be there on which the bird life depend. I think the report was a little exaggerated, but that's no criticism of the reporter, who I know well, but it does show a point that 15, 20 years ago, oilseed rape was decried by many as a vile invader of our countryside. And I think what people need to recognise is a fundamental point here. There is a hypothesis often portrayed that it is impossible to farm intensively and environmentally sensitively at the same time. Now, I hear this time and time again, and on my farm in the Vale of York, I've sought to disprove that theory. I happened to get into debate with the director of policy of the RSPB about 3 years ago at another place in London. And I said, I tell you what, you send your people to survey my farm and come and look at what I'm doing and check the wildlife on my farm. for the whole year. They did that for the whole of last year, and they set targets, simple targets, Mike. Set a target that my farm should achieve 43 different species of bird. At the end of the year, we had 57, although I have to say I was a bit dubious being 48 miles from the sea when one of those lists was a cormorant, but still, they put it down. I didn't say it. I wasn't taking part in it. And in the letter they wrote to me, that they hoped their demonstration farm in Sandy and Bedford could achieve those targets in the future. Now, I'm not a special farmer, because my average wheat yield last year was just short of 10 tonnes per hectare. The national averages last year was about 8 tonnes. So I'm above average. But what I've done is farm the land, my farm that my father had and my grandfather bought in June 1940, with sensitivity, holistically. You can farm intensively on part of the land as long as you look after the complementary parts. And you put the two together. And when they came round and walked round the farm with me, they pointed out to that. Now, I would submit this is a similar point that flows from these results of the field scale evaluations. What it has shown is that if you farmed every inch of the farm in this way, you'd have an effect on weeds, and therefore you would have an effect on biodiversity. But I don't think anybody does that. Indeed, one of the major changes that has come about as we become more aware of the need for this harmony that needs to take place is the concept of the environmental schemes, which Michael was instrumental in introducing, known as the Countryside Stewardship Scheme, is one of them, where we promote putting strips around fields and we put it back to a mixture of old-type grasses, which is a haven for wildlife to come in. And I point out that if you put a 6-metre strip round a 25-acre, 10-hectare field, do you work in hectares or acres here? Whichever. Hectare field, you will account for in excess of 10% of that surface area is going into some form of buffer and barrier that is important. Now, I hope as a result of these field scale evaluations that we will have a better debate. But I fear all too often we will not have, because I feel the perceptions have been made by putting statements in the way that Michael has put them, of putting one possible situation with gut bacteria, and then we keep repeating to it later and later and later on in his presentation, give the impression that this is actually a fact. There's plenty of things can be scared about what we do. There are plenty of things with allergies. Actually, the other way around comes with allergies. It could well be by understanding the genomes, we can prevent the allergies actually being a problem. And certainly issues like nut allergies could be addressed in that way, knowing what we're doing. Equally, Michael said the challenge was perhaps demonstrate a demand. Now, that's a very real point. As a farmer who has to depend on selling his produce, there is absolutely no point at all in me growing a crop if you don't want it. That is fundamental. Equally, there's no point at me growing a crop if the costs of production, and hence the economics of it, are inferior to what is there traditionally. That is something that is just absolutely bottom line. Bottom line also is that any crop we grow must be passed on safety grounds with regard to environmental interactions. Yes, you may need to have extra checks once you've gone forward, but that's a given. Now, what about this question of coexistence? Now, a lot's talked about this. We've heard all sorts of scare stories about pollen that travels 25, 30 miles. We had a big scare story in Mexico where it had moved a great distance until we found actually somebody had moved the seed, and it wasn't that at all. The reality is this. Too many people make comments about how far pollen travels. The critical factor in this is how far does pollen travel and remain viable? And that is a fundamentally smaller distance than how far pollen travels. And we do have a lot of experience in this, because as farmers, we grow different crops or different status of crops. Whereas we breed a crop, we grow the grandparent and so through. We call it basic, and the pre-basic, basic, and then first generation, second generation, and generation seeds. And when we're breeding pure seeds, we need to maintain their properties because there'll be a bread wheat, a feed wheat, there'll be different sorts of bread wheat with different resistances in there for different situations. In oilseed rape, even more important is that we have a rape for the food industry and we have what is called a high uric acid rape, the acronym here. The food industry one is low. We don't want the two to mix. We have evolved practices that have not compromised those two existences by separation distances and by farming practices. And to say quite bluntly, Michael, as you did, that farmers, when they go out then and use it in common practice, will just do it a different way, is absolute rubbish. Just as it was rubbish to say farmers never, ever just apply one dose of herbicide. Because something to prove of the pudding there is in itself is the atrazine that you mentioned is one herbicide applied once, and that's all you need to do. I will only apply one herbicide to the most of my crops, although I will admit that in sugar beet, we do apply more than one dose of herbicide, because that's the procedure now we go on with third rates, very much lower rates, more than once, because it's more effective that way. But the reality is that in the issue of coexistence, we know a lot about separation distances. We know how to keep them pure with the normal limits of purity. We're talking about 99.97% in terms of first generation seeds. That's from the standards we have to achieve, a little bit lower for second generation seeds. There is therefore a lot that can be learnt from that and taken on into developing this whole new technology. Now, I think time's passing on, so I'm going to miss over a lot of what I was going to say and pick up on one final point, need, demand. Demand is critical. I think a lot of that has been put on the back burner because at the moment people have become frightened. And I think Michael is right. One of the things that BSC did was to create a lack of trust in science generically in this country, whether it's the GM crops, whether it's pesticide use, whether it's anything to do with science. I think that's a big problem that science has to address. But what I hope we can do is develop a more balanced debate in this country, one that is based on fact. I personally think the way out of this will be to go forward and develop the crops in an area that don't go into food, that go into non-food. I personally, so that as much as I'm allowed to have personal views these days, am very concerned about the effects worldwide of climate change. They are here. I think increasingly more people recognise that, although there are a few who still argue it's within the aberrations of normal climatic variation. I think we might agree on that as well, Michael.
Totally.
Yeah? It worries me enormously, though, that we're doing so little about it. The cost in Europe of the droughts this year of lost production amount on first estimates to €13.1 billion. And yet the Treasury will not put in a proper value for carbon in their carbon balance sheet if we can stop burning fossil fuels in the way we do. The potential for crops to be much more than food production, but to be what they were a century ago or more, producers of raw materials for industry, to be, as Professor Sir Tom Bundell often say, the pure factory, the pure biorefinery, is actually enormous. If I give you one simple example, Michael, you remember full well that Kyoto set a target for reduction of gases, of NOx gases, of 10%. That was the target set. By pure coincidence, 10% of all emissions of NOx come as a byproduct from the production of the raw material precursor for nylon, adipic acid. We now find in that little herb, coriander, a long fatty acid chain called petrosilicic acid that breaks down into lauric acid, which goes into cosmetics, and the aforesaid adipic acid, without any NOx emissions at all. But the yield is too low to be economic at the moment. But using GM technologies, we could move that along very quickly. There's an enormous benefit there to be had. Given the environmental aspects are proven, there's a real yield, it's a real benefit, not just in yield absolute terms, but in, for the society as a whole to be delivered. There are many, many more examples like that where we can use maize starch or wheat starch as the building block of industry. And the use of GM to help improve the yield of that is very critical in going forward. Finally, I think the use also can build on a point that Chris made. It could help us significantly reduce the synthetic pesticides we have to use to balance out a crop and ensure we have that crop at the end of the day. In the 50s and early 60s, we had a group of major diseases in rust that cost us very dearly. They were known as rusts, yellow rust, brown rust. By traditional breeding methods, the plant breeders produced varieties that were rust resistant. This was a marvellous step forward. But suddenly then, having got rid of rust, we had another disease such as septoria. Now the critics might say, well, that just proves you shouldn't meddle with God. You shouldn't meddle with plant breeding. Some of the work that is being carried out at the moment in genome analysis, looking at the older varieties of wheat that were used that had these rust problems, would now suggest that when the meddling way that we used to do the plant breeding, which is just simply back-crossing and mixing everything up and seeing what we got out of it, at the same time as we bred in the rust resistance, we inadvertently bred out the natural septoria resistance that was there in those older varieties. Now, this is where I take issue again with you, Michael, when you said it's a very crude technology. This is the reality that the old breeding procedures were a very crude technology. That's what happened. With the use of genetic modification or genetic GM technologies, we can specifically pick which ones we want to put in there. If we had not had that output, we would not have had to spend hundreds of millions of pounds on that fungicide and use over that period. So, where are we going? We have a long way to go in taking the public with us, but we need to explain it and have a proper rational debate and take that through to ensure that everybody can be happy with where we turn out.
Thank you. Our first discussant is Professor George Gaskell, Professor of Social Psychology and Director of the Methodology Institute at the LSE. He's also Deputy Director of BIOS. He's currently coordinating a European Commission research project on life sciences in European society, which is working in 14 European countries, with associate projects in Canada and the USA. And this is looking at public perceptions, elite media coverage, and regulatory activities concerning modern biotechnologies. George.
Well, I get a sense of déjà vu, I should say déjà entendu, this evening. Martin Bauer, who's taken the cheapest seat in the balcony, and I have been working on biotechnology for about 10 years, and particularly on biotechnology as it reveals itself in public debates in the public sphere more generally.
George, can
I
just use the mic?
Oh, sorry.
It comes out of the cable.
Do I have to hold? Well, I start singing a song. So we've been looking at biotechnology debates over the last 10 years, Martin Bauer, my colleague, and I, and one of the things I noticed this evening is that while the specific points in the debate change, somehow the framework doesn't change that much. On the one hand, we have the go-for-it group, Professor Pollock, then we have Michael Meacher saying, wait and see, more evidence, and so forth. Then we have Sir Ben Gill talking about, the field scale evaluations in particular, and using these as an illustration of the way in which information gets perhaps distorted, how the debate doesn't stick to the facts, and how he makes a plea for the quality of better debates. And, you know, in many respects, one looks back over the discussions in this country and more so in some of the other northern European countries, which reflect rather similar concerns. And what always intrigues me about this is how long this debate's going on, because biotechnology has been controversial for perhaps 30 years, and still we have these debates and requests for, you know, more facts, more realistic debate, more scientific evidence, etc., etc. It starts off being controversial in the United States in Asilomar in the early 1970s, when scientists got together concerned, having discovered recombinant DNA techniques, that these might have an effect on biodiversity, on the evolutionary process, on laboratory technicians. And a voluntary moratorium was introduced. It lasted about a year. Scientists more or less satisfied themselves. And possibly there was a bit of an economic imperative to get going with biotechnology and ensure that America and some of the other countries didn't fall behind, possibly the Japanese, who were also working on it. And then not really very much happens, if I come back to this country, until the early 1990s, when the first products of biotechnology come through at the level of consumers. And the first one, curiously enough, vegetarian cheese, so-called, is made with an enzyme which is a genetically modified organism. And by some extraordinary way, whilst organic agriculture excludes GMOs, apparently organic cheese can have them, and that may be because it's nicer to produce this enzyme in a test tube, so to speak, than take the rennet out of the out of calves. Now, there was very little stir about that, although the Vegetarian Society did have a bit of a debate as to whether it could be accepted. Then, in about 1995, a tomato puree, and I should have brought my can along to show you, a genetically modified tomato puree came on the shelves of Sainsbury's and Safeway supermarkets. It was labeled as such, product of genetic modification. No particular concerns about it, apparently sold quite well. And it was dropped because although it got the European, as it got the British approval, they couldn't face the struggle of some new European regulations for approval of such products. And then things really went a bit crazy in this country in 1996, and two things happened. Well, 1996-97. Firstly, the importation for the first time of genetically modified soya, that's the famous Monsanto GM soya, and this was going to go into the food chain, and apparently it was not going to be labeled as such. And so people got a bit queasy about that. And then in February 1997, and not really too much to do with modern biotechnology, Dolly the sheep is cloned. But this was sort of emblematic, almost, of the potential power of this technology to influence not merely foodstuffs, but reproduction, etc. Contraception said we could have sex without having children, and cloning said, well, we can have children without even having sex. And so starts the what we call the watershed years of biotechnology, 1996 to 1999, really significant debates across Europe, and they are accompanied, as our speakers have said, by the BSE-CJD crisis, by various problems with food in Europe. As I recall, there were Belgian chickens which were fed with old motor oil, and there were various other bits and bobs that came out with it, but certainly a suspicion, a growing suspicion of industrialized agriculture. 1999 sees the moratorium, a de facto moratorium, because a large number of European states said they were not prepared to agree to the approval of the commercial releases of GM crops. And the moratorium is still in existence. Earlier this month, a regulatory committee in Europe considered a genetically modified maize produced by a European company, delicately, not an American company, and this would have been sold as a can of maize labeled under the new regulations for labeling. And the committee felt unable to come to a decision on this because Austria, Greece and Italy were vehemently against. Oddly enough, this country, supported by the Netherlands and Spain, were in favour. They'll come back to that decision in December, and I think it'll be quite a crucial one in terms of what happens to GM foods. Now, I wonder really sometimes when we look back at this and we say, right, we need a good debate. And the problem with a good debate today is that the present is a synthesis of the past, and there's a great deal of suspicion raised from a number of quarters about genetic modification. So vast numbers of people in this country think they're already eating GM foods, and that the government has been hiding this from us. People are also concerned, as Michael Meacher and others have said, with the spectre of BSE, the idea that somehow something that is safe today may be shown relatively soon, it may jump a generation and appear with deleterious consequences. So there are lots of reasons why the rational debate, so-called, is rather difficult, because this debate carries so much extra baggage. And as we have seen over the last 5 years, GM becomes related to anti-globalization, anti-Americanism, anti-capitalism, anti-environmental pollution. I'm sure I could name 10 different antis that come into this rainbow coalition that is just suspicious about genetic modification. But there are also the consumers, the European public, and I think Michael Meacher is spot on. A great deal of debate went on in the late 1990s about the public misperceiving the risks. Scientists say there's no risk, or at least they cannot determine a risk, and the public were suspicious. They thought there might be a risk. And at least one section of our research shows a persuasive number of Europeans who, it's not risk that worries them, it's the benefit, the absence of benefit. See, most of the GM crops at the moment are commodity crops, and essentially, if they're produced more efficiently and they're produced more cheaply, that's of enormous benefit to seed manufacturers, to farmers, and possibly to the producers. But by the time it gets down through the food chain into your pizza or whatever it might be, whether the GM soy is grown 20% more efficiently is absolutely irrelevant to the price of the product. So given that there wasn't, and you know, in the London School of Economics, one has to acknowledge price as a benefit, or at least lower price as a benefit, but given that people just couldn't see any benefits from these things for themselves, then the question was, what's the point? And at a time when most people walk around supermarkets and there is a superfluity of choice, foods from here, there, and everywhere around the world, going to a supermarket is almost to confront existential dilemmas as to what on earth one should be buying in this panoply of choice. Why do we need another whole range of things to make these decisions even more problematic? And I think this has been really what I would think of as the Achilles heel of genetic modification in agriculture, in offering no benefits, apparently, to the end user, the consumer, then any suggestion that comes from anywhere about a potential risk down the line to health, to the environment, these are all somewhat accentuated. And so my final point would be, yes, I think public debates are a grand idea. It's a pity we didn't start, not this debate, but in Europe, a debate about GM some 10 years ago. And the idea that the debate can only be rational is a dangerous one, because who defines rationality? Now, some people would define objective risk assessment as rational because it's based on sound science, etc. But I would want to contend that risk assessment, who identifies the risk, how the risks are measured, etc., are to some extent social constructions. They are a consensus currently amongst many scientists, but they're not necessarily of the same value as other scientific observations. There are relatively few warrants to support risk assessments, particularly in the context of uncertainties. And if there are uncertainties, then the public's uncertainties also have to be given some space to be considered. That said, and I really ought to just make a final comment on a great debate which we had in this country called GM Nation, which was quoted in The Guardian as the largest public survey of genetically modified organisms to be conducted in this country. 37,000 people were involved, And The Guardian concluded that 4 out of 5 Britons were opposed to GM foods. Sadly, no valid conclusion whatsoever can be drawn from the GM nation debate about the distribution, the prevalence of positive and negative attitudes amongst the British public to GM foods. Our own research is somewhat more valid in this respect, coming from social scientists and having a little bit of sampling theory attached to it, and I would estimate that the British public are quite ambivalent. It's around 50% in favour and 50% against. Thank you.
Thank you. Our final contributor this evening is Professor Tim Dyson, Professor of Population Studies at the LSE, based in the Development Studies Institute. His research interests span across global population trends, family planning, and the AIDS epidemic, but he has also made a particular study of world food systems, agricultural production, and food security. Tim.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you very much, Yvonne.
Microphone, please.
Microphone, okay. Well, as Yvonne said, I made it plain when she asked me that I'm not an expert on GM crops. I'm a demographer, and I've had an interest in world food trends for 10 to 15 years or so. My only real connection with GM is that I might as well say at the outset that I have visited the laboratories of Monsanto in St. Louis and also the John Innes Centre up in Norwich. It seems a few obvious things, or they seem obvious to me. Firstly, the term GM covers a great many things. It's not a single technology, and it's a technology which is constantly evolving and being refined. Clearly, the technology isn't going to go away. We can't uninvent it. It's here. Clearly, it has potential advantages, as well as, no doubt, problems and some risks. So, clearly, I would take it that, as with any new technology, we need to use it carefully with respect to the environment and health, and ethically as well, because clearly there are moral dimensions to some of the things that are sometimes proposed. This technology, obviously, I would say, requires oversight and regulation, both within the UK and no doubt within the EU. And as a demographer, I'm reminded of institutions like the UK Human Fertilisation and Embryology Authority. We have it. It has people on it. It tries to figure out what is right. Sometimes it doesn't get it exactly right. There are grey areas and so on, but that's the sort of thing we should have, and I believe we should have it with respect to GM. However, how GM develops outside the UK and outside the EU in the long run, I'm sure, is going to have a significant influence for what happens within the UK and within the EU. After all, people nowadays can't have certain human fertilization techniques applied in the UK, but they go to Italy, and maybe that will have an influence on what we do here in the longer run. Okay, so a bit of demography. As Michael said, there's about 6 billion people in the world. In 25 years' time, the UN says it'll be about 8 billion, which is more or less going to be right. It can't be too far wrong. That means currently we're adding an extra billion people every 12 or 13 years. Extra billion every 12 or 13 years. There are only about 2 billion people on the whole planet when Chris was born. Most of this demographic growth is occurring in developing countries, and it's going to go up to 9 billion, okay? Probably a bit more. But I won't go into that. So that's a 50% increase in the human population in just the next few decades. And these newcomers, they're not just births. This is the excess of births over deaths. This increase in the human population, well, they've got to be fed. And it's not going to be easy, especially if, as obviously we all hope, the quality of the diet is improved at the same time, particularly with respect to the variety, getting away from monotonous diets, which persist in many parts of the world, and also increasing the protein content is undoubtedly important too. Now, what I would say to you is that if we're concerned to protect the global environment, you can only get more stuff out in two ways. You can either increase the area that's harvested, or you can increase the yield. Currently, in the world as a whole, about 700 million hectares is harvested of cereals. Okay, if the world's population is going to go up by 50%, we can bring another 350 million hectares into cereal cultivation. We'd be crazy to do that. It would have all sorts of stupid effects. And thank God that's not the way the world's going to go. We're going to take the second path, which is raising yields. You want one reason for GM crops, it's their potential to contribute to increasing yields. Now, raising yields is a complex process on which, especially in poor, densely populated countries like China, Egypt, Pakistan, for example, we already find that agriculture highly dependent upon an industrial process. You go to the Red River Delta, you see people working out the fields, it looks oh so natural, but they're highly dependent upon synthetic nitrogen, the Haber-Bosch process for the synthesis of ammonia. And although nitrogen can be used more or less carefully, and of course it should be used more carefully, we can't get away from it, ultimately, the human population. Today, worldwide, synthetic fertilizers provide about 40% of all the nitrogen taken up by food crops. And that fraction is very much higher in countries like China or Vietnam. Now, GM food crops won't solve the world's food problem. No one would make such a statement. But with lots of other approaches and technologies, they clearly have the capacity to help. To help. I'm a demographer. Those are the two Chinese characteristics, figures, which together mean one word, population. On the left is a person. On the right is an open mouth. Deep in the consciousness is the notion that food is required. And with characteristic boldness, the Chinese especially are taking to GM in a big way. Of course, they do everything bold, whether it's building dams or bringing down birth rates, but that's another issue. So GM crops carefully approached and used can, for example, increase drought resistance. They can dwarf plants, which leads to a higher harvest index and also reduces prospects for lodging. And they can reduce requirements for pesticides and fungicides. So in helping to raise yields, in as a small part of that, I think they can benefit the environment. Moreover, some applications, as most people in the room will know, like vitamin A-enriched forms of rice, can be directly beneficial for human health. Whether we like it or not, worldwide, and personally I'm not so averse to it, GM technologies are going to be used increasingly by farmers. The real problem is to how to get these technologies focused on the needs of poor farmers on small pieces of land. And that's going to be difficult, but that's what we need to do. And the private companies are not going to do it, so the public sector, one way or another, has got to be involved. So, in conclusion, carefully used, GM technologies can help the global environment. They can benefit human health, I believe, and help reduce poverty. There's promise there. And the Green Revolution, my friend and colleague Michael Lipton tells me, the Green Revolution did help in reducing poverty. Well, my last comment, and it is the last comment, is that it strikes me, I don't buy British newspapers because I don't think much of them. But much of the public debate on this issue, as in some others, I have to say, seems to me of poor quality. So far as GM is concerned, I hope we don't make the mistake in this country which we did with this thing. This is an LSE canteen fork. You can see that it's potentially dangerous. Undoubtedly, it's potentially dangerous. And after its initial introduction into the UK, there were, believe it or believe it not, strong ethical and religious objections to using this thing. It took about 150 years for the population of this country to become accustomed to the fork. Thank you.
Thank you. Right. We don't have quite as much time as we planned, but we do have some time for questions. So we have mics in the audience. If people would like to put up their hands, if they'd like to ask a question or make a comment. And I'd ask you please to keep it relatively short. We'll have one up in the balcony first.
On the DuPont technique for growing, I believe it was glucose, to contribute to producing ethanol for motor vehicles, it was mentioned in The Economist's World in 2004. Now, that brings in the idea that you can get the carbon for automobile fuel from the atmosphere, thereby providing a powerful solution to climate change problems. Do you think this creates a difficulty with priorities for the environmental movement in choosing between a climate change solution, which could mean widespread genetic modification?
Who would like to have a go at that one?
I'm happy to start off with that. I mean, I don't really think there's any serious conflict there, to be perfectly honest. I mean, the problems of climate change are really not at all to do with what you've been talking about. It is to do with the burning of fossil fuels on a colossal scale, oil, coal, and some lesser extent gas. It is to do with transport emissions. It's to do with industrial emissions, and it is to do with some burning within the domestic sector. Now, what you're referring to, again, will have some small, probably fairly marginal impact on that, but it really is not going to make much of a contribution to, if we did exactly what you're proposing, to a solution of global warming. That requires, first of all, a tightening of the Kyoto targets and a reduction by all industrial countries, particularly America, in all the respects that I've been talking about. So again, I think it's useful, but I don't think there's any serious conflict.
The flow of carbon in the biosphere is about 10 times the annual flow of man-made emissions. This represents a major opportunity to produce carbon-neutral technologies, which have to go hand-in-hand with more effective use of energy, but nevertheless can play a significant part. I think your analysis is absolutely spot on. To generate the maximum gain from this, particularly in the development of feedstocks, where you pay a double price, both in terms of extraction and subsequent refining, it's very difficult for me to see how this can be done effectively without a much greater use of genetic manipulation than is currently employed.
Okay, there's a question here.
Shara Ali, co-author of the Green Party's recent submission to the first report in the GM Science Review, which is a 298-page report produced by the government. Well, firstly, if I may, could I just congratulate Michael Meacher for his moral and intellectual stature? You're a beacon to us, a beacon amongst a world of salesmen, if I may say. What I want to draw attention to, really, and there's very little I can add to your words of wisdom, really, but just taking a couple of points, really, as provocations.
Can I ask you to keep it brief?
I shall keep it very brief. Firstly, we're told that the debate needs to be aired more broadly. We've just had a GM nation debate, and we have a speaker telling us that how to turn 80% into 50%. Lies, damn lies and statistics, I tell you. And then we're told that most people would prefer to be given the choice. Now, who wouldn't want to be given a choice? That is a total evasion of the issue. The question is, if you want GM, would you be prepared to have a choice? And most people have already answered that they don't want GM. So being asked, you know, whether you want a choice if you're forced to have GM on the market isn't really the issue.
Thank you. Maybe you want to respond to that?
Yes. I'm rather upset to be associated with the lies and damned lies, but statistics actually do make a difference in these matters.
Right. Can I take a question on this side, Lady in Orange? There's a mic coming if you just pause.
I'd like to say that no matter what MAF or any scientist or any GM production corporation says, there are no circumstances under which we have the right to interfere with the building blocks of nature. Genetic modification is completely different from any other form of engineered breeding. In other forms, nature has the final say as to what particular combination works out. Cross-pollination with organic crops is inevitable, and it will be the death of organic farming. I think we should be looking in this island to specialise in organic farming and to tell the GM lobby to go and get lost. There is nothing more fundamental and crucial than our food, and preventing genetic modification from being accepted in the UK is one of the most important issues of our time.
Thank you. Anybody want to respond? I think it was a statement, really.
I thought that was a question.
down the front, please. Yeah.
Thanks. I somehow missed the global dimension to the debate a little bit in what all the speakers were saying, I mean, despite of what Professor Gaskell was talking about. And I have a slight problem with the use of the BSC crisis as one of the justifications for the criticisms of the GM acceptance in this country. I think we need to acknowledge that we're dealing with a global debate here that goes well beyond the specific issues related to UK agriculture. So I found the discussion a bit too narrow in that respect. And I think the issue of risk is the key issue, as was highlighted, I think, quite rightly by Michael Meacher. And I think instead of comparing what is happening with the introduction of the fork or the introduction of the railway in the 19th century, one of the key parallel debates, arguably, would be the introduction of nuclear power in the 1950s and 1960s and the promises that were made then as nuclear power as a solution to energy problems, and we see what dilemma globally society has in dealing with that problem. I think that's the dimension we should pitch the discussions on. Thank you.
Does anybody wish to respond quickly on that?
Well, there is a dimension to that as to what one means by a global debate. Is that the advanced countries debating what is good for the less developed countries? Because what one finds, I mean, if we look to the east, China, India, the Philippines, Thailand, these are countries which are going gung-ho for genetically modified agriculture. The same is true of Latin America, and the same is true of North America. Now, in many of those, and I'd probably include North America, whether there is much of a public sphere debating these issues is open to question. In the main, the technology has been imposed top-down through government regulations, and there is very little discussion in these countries. So I'm not quite sure what you mean by a global debate and who are the participants.
Ben and then Michael.
I think you're quite right to point out there's no logic in connecting BSC with GM crops. But I think the central point is this. What BSC did was make people very much more concerned about their food and started a debate for zero risk. Now, the reality is zero risk is not an option. You know, we've heard the Stoon and so on. On average, 19 people every year die in England and Wales from falling out of bed. You know, so what do you do? There is a risk to everything we do, but you seek to minimise the risk. And it's explaining that risk and explaining what goes with it and how we go. But I think I'll add one more point. I think our society is going to be faced with some major challenges which will contradict. Now, I understand the point you make about nuclear energy, but I think the issue of climate change is going to be so all-consuming in the future, we're going to have to make decisions about where we get our energy from, or we are going to have to dramatically reduce our energy needs. And I don't see the public, no matter how well-intentioned this group here might be, voluntarily giving up that energy need, which is actually rising almost exponentially at the moment. And these are the sort of issues that we have to take head-on. And GM is one in there because it can reduce that energy need by using plants and doing it in a circle.
I think you are right to draw attention to the question of risk, and I must say where I do really rather strongly disagree with what I think everyone else on that panel has said is a dismissal of risk on the basis of what are actually really rather comic examples. I mean, I think this is not to take the issue at all seriously. When you're dealing with a totally new situation, a new technology, you cannot make comparisons with what may or may not have happened in other cases. And I do think, I mean, the point I think that you were making about nuclear energy is not relating it to BSE, but it's just that this was said to be the great discovery of the age after the war, which was going to solve the world's energy problems forever and ever. And initially it looked as though it might, but it didn't. And we now find that there are some very, very substantial downside risks. So I think the moral of that is not, again, to be frightened of new technology, new science, but to be extremely careful about it and to introduce these things very, very slowly. I repeat, the only reason for doing this at speed is the commercial demands of the biotech companies. If we took 50 or 100 years over it, there would be nothing wrong in that in terms of what is good for public welfare. It is only the biotech companies. And only, if I may just make what Professor Gaskell said, The fact is, GM production is not all that widespread around the world. 66% of it is in the US, 23% is in Canada, 6% is in China, and 6% is in Canada, and 4% in China, and the rest of the world, the whole of the rest of the world, is less than 1%. It is four countries overwhelmingly, and in the case of China, they are beginning to have serious thoughts. So I don't think we should think that this is an inevitable revolution at all. It is one which is fairly limited, overwhelmingly dominated by the North American continent and the United States and the companies in it. And many, the vast majority of other countries are deeply suspicious of it. That's the truth.
I see a lot of hands in the air. Unfortunately, we do have to finish up by 8 o'clock. So can I please invite you all to join us up in a reception up on the fifth floor of this building in the senior dining room and carry on some of the discussion vigorously over a glass of wine or orange juice. But I would like to, before we do that, to ask you to join me in thanking all our contributors for what I think has been a really lively and fascinating discussion.